talk to Mark, call 602-508-0960. That's 602-508-0960. Now, once again, here's Mark.
Welcome back, everybody. For the next 2 hours, we're talking about car repair problems, pricing. What should I do about this? And I have a vibration nobody can fix. And my air conditioning system doesn't seem to work good when it's 30 degrees. And I'm told that I need to have synthetic oil put in my car. And my neighbor changes his filter once a year, but he says oil never wears out. Any of that kind of stuff. Any of the wives' tales you want to discuss. Or ladies, if you have a question and your dad did it one way but your husband does it another, we're pretty good at settling those kinds of arguments. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Larry Harker's Auto Repair. They've been around since 1967 at the same location, 38th Avenue and Indian School. Now, Bob and Ellen run and operate and are responsible for Larry Harker's Auto, and they can do everything from a lot auto electrical services, brake service, auto emissions, vehicle maintenance. But what Bob is he's a diagnostician extraordinaire. He has the tenacity and, more important, the knowledge of how cars and trucks work, so he can find the problem. So he's pulled more than one rabbit out of his hat. I've sent customers from Central Phoenix and actually from all over the valley that he was the most convenient shop, and he's just done a great job. So Larry Harker's Auto, 38th Avenue and Indian School. As many of you probably know, we've had some real technical problems on and off over the last year. And last night, we changed everything. So I had purchased some new piece of equipment, which is called an Access NX. And it's a piece of equipment that they have to have one too. The radio station has to have one too. So the two of them can talk to one another. We had been trying to do that over a telephone line. That did not work. And now we're connected over the internet. And last night we did a bunch of testing and everything's fine. So we think, of course I've said this before, we think the problem is solved. So we're hoping and praying that that's going to be the issue. But together we worked hard at putting that together. But it was just a miserable thing for Gil, who runs he's the engineer and the producer that runs the show, as well as me, because our connection kept getting disturbed. And there was times I could hear him and the caller, and during that period of time he couldn't hear me. Then there was times that the whole system would just shut down and we'd have to reboot. And you know how long it takes a computer to reboot and then for somebody to push a button and type in a phone number and all that other kind of stuff. So we feel pretty confident that, together we've whipped this dragon that's been beating us up for the last year. When it comes to car repair, one of the things that most of us that own car repair shops are experiencing is customers are looking up the parts on the internet. And they're saying, we had one just the other day, you know, that part on the internet is $40 and you charged me $140. Well, there's two sides to the story, and I just want to discuss both sides. First of all, I'm real aware of what we buy parts for, and I know that I can go on the internet and buy that part cheaper than I can buy it here locally. It's no reflection on the people that I'm doing business with. It's the process. So my parts are made by the manufacturer, and by the time they get to the local warehouse, there's maybe two people, maybe three in the middle. Somebody transports it from where it's at to a distribution center, and then from a distribution center it's transported to the warehouse of the parts place I have, whether it's CarQuest or NAPA or whether it's Factory or Parts Authority. They all have distribution warehouses. Then from there, it goes to me. And then from me, it goes to the customer. So, it's all related to volume. So the higher the volume, the better price you get. And of course, if your credit's good and you pay when you're supposed to, and there's so many different factors. How many parts do you return? How many parts are defective? How often do you have a bad part compared to everybody else in the world? So the issue is many of those parts are cheaper than mine because they skipped two or three of the steps through the chain. So it goes from the manufacturer to the distributor, and then the distributor basically flows to the customer. The problem with that is that here's the bad side. Let's say, for instance, that you bring your own mass airflow sensor. Now, the mass airflow sensor is a device that measures the amount of air that's going into the engine, and the computer monitors that. So the computer knows that the number, and I'm giving you just BS numbers here just to help you understand. Let's go on a 1 to 10 scale. The computer knows that the air coming into the motor is a 1, and it knows that it's at idle. Then the air coming into the motor is a 10, and they know that your foot's on the floor. So the mass airflow sensor is an integral part of a computer-operated car. So if we put your mass airflow sensor on, because you want to bring your own part, if the problem is still there, then the fight starts. Because the customer, rightfully so, may say, your diagnosis is defective, and the part right and the shop, rightfully so, could say, your part's defective. And at this point, it's the shop feels that it's their responsibility to prove their diagnosis was right, so they're going to go buy a mass airflow sensor, stick it on your car, go drive it, find out it is okay, take theirs off, put it back on, and all of that is free. In order to prove that we diagnosed it right, in order to prove that we installed the part right, we have to go in and do all of that. So many of us, me included, we're not going to do that. The problem is the part that you get from the internet, most likely, it's about 50% sure it's been installed before. And you get the part from the internet, and there's no warranty on the part. So you don't have a labor warranty. You might have a part warranty. But if the part has an take it off and put it on price of $80, then you're going to have to pay the $80 to put it back on if your part fails. Plus, you're going to have to send the part back to the distributor, and then the distributor is going to send you a new part, and you're going to have your receipt. So there's all these moving parts that goes. Now, I can tell you that I've copied from other guys, and I'll give you a couple examples. I have a lot of older gentlemen that are customers of mine that are car guys, and they're diesel guys, and they're farmers, and they're ranchers, and they pull boats and motor homes and trailers and all that kind of stuff. And there's a few of them that just love AMSOIL. It's not an oil I stock. AMSOIL is kind of like Avon. It's a multi-tiered marketing strategy. So there's guys in town that sell AMSOIL, and there's guys in town that won't put anything else in their car. So as a result of that, I don't want to stock AMSOIL, so I have customers. Now, if they just use me for oil changes, I probably won't extend them that courtesy to bring their oil in, because obviously this time frame generates less money and sometimes half as much money if they bring their own oil in. But most of my customers, I get to rotate their tires and I get to flush their cooling systems and all that kind of stuff. So it kind of all washes out at the end or gets close. So I've copied that from other shop owners. So if, and I'm not doing it for a customer that's brand new. I'm looking up, and you've been doing business with me for 7 years, and I have, you know, 7 work orders on you, or 14 work orders on you, or, God forbid, 21 work orders on you. I already know that. So our computer system, as well as everybody else's, has that information available to us. So, and then there's times that son in Pittsburgh calls and says, you know, my mom is there and she has to have an air conditioning compressor put on and some other parts, and I'm in the auto repair industry, or I want to buy those parts here in Pittsburgh, or can I send the parts to you? And I look up, mom's been a customer since 1979 or older. Mom's been around a very long time. Mom's never been a problem. Every one of her checks has always been good. And I got a son in Pittsburgh that wants to help his mother out. And so I'm gamer. I'm a guy that'll do that. It's not something, and I'll say to him, this is something I don't want to make a habit to, but I'll tell you what I'll do on your behalf. I'm going to discount the parts to your mother. I'm going to come way under my estimate, and I'm going to do it for you this one time. I'll discount my parts to what your purchase price is. So you give me your numbers, and I'll discount them that way. But this is a one-time deal. And how are we going to handle the notification of your mother? Am I going to say that you plunked a bunch of money down on her bill because I'm going to discount the parts? So you need to help me figure that out. And that happens every once in a while. It happens 3, 4, 5, 6 times a year where we have a dad with a daughter at ASU or a son at ASU. We've got some relative that's far away that wants to help a relative here in town, and they find out that the car is at ABC shop. So they call. Those are the kinds of things that we have a tough time with, is kind of dividing up our attention. But the real problem with the parts is your car is going to be at our facility for 2 or 3 days while your part gets to you and then it gets to us. So that car presents a risk because it's there for a long time and it's what we call a dead fish. So it's sitting there. And, of course, tow truck drivers have had a bad habit of hitting cars in our facility. So as my technicians, they'll back one car in and crash the other. So when you look at the big picture, it's really not a good thing for us, because that technician is going to work on your car on Monday. The part will come in on Wednesday to your house. You'll bring it to us on Thursday. And now all of a sudden you've saved what effectively is $65 or something like that. So those are the trials we're having right now, and it just has to do with technology. But I will tell you this much. Not too long ago, a huge manufacturer has a very prominent member of the operation of this auto parts manufacturer here in Phoenix. And him and I were talking, and he said, we're pulling out of all those website places. We're not going to sell our parts to them anymore, and they're not going to be able to sell our parts. And I said, ooh, that's kind of an interesting concept. How come? And he says, people are using our parts to diagnose their cars. So they order a mass airflow sensor, and they plug it in. Now, the reason why we know we plug it in is because the electrical connection has a white grease inside of it that has the consistency of toothpaste. It's supposed to seal the connection. So you take the wire and you plug it in. I'm telling you, everybody knows it's been plugged in. There's just no way around it. So he says, we get 50% of our parts back because someone plugged in the mass airflow sensor because they had a mass airflow code, which one doesn't equal the other. And they plugged it in. It didn't work. So they put it back in the box and they returned it as defective. He says, we're losing our butt with those internet parts places. Now, one last thing. The internet parts place takes the order. He gives a credit card to the local distributor. The local distributor bills his credit card, and the local distributor then puts it in UPS or FedEx. And that guy may handle two states. So then it's going to be put on UPS or FedEx, and it's going to be taken to you. Now, it's not going to be expedited mail, I can tell you that much, because you're not paying a bunch. The bottom line is that's how it's working. So at least one of the major manufacturers is saying, I'm not doing that anymore because I'm losing my tail end. And obviously that's a problem. So 602-508-0960, I know I have a call on hold. We're going to come back after the break, and you will be the very first words out of my mouth. We'll be back in a minute. Back, everybody, and just like I promised, we're going straight to John because he's been waiting through the break. John, what is it I can do for you today, or what do you question you need answered?
I got a 98 Grand Marquis with about 140,000 miles on it, and intermittently it doesn't want to start, and I just happened to one time I wanted to check to see if it was fuel on the fuel rail. So I pushed down on the Schrader valve and a little fuel dribbled out. And then I got back in and it would start. And it's done that twice.
Okay.
Does that tell you anything?
Yeah, I think I can help you, but I want to say first of all, on a warm motor, it's really, really a bad idea to... And the Schrader valve, folks, looks like the valve stem on your tire. That's what it looks like. And it's a threaded device with a little valve inside of it. And you hook your gauge to it to check fuel pressure. But if you take your finger or you take your ink pen and you push on it, it can have 40 to 60 pounds of pressure. And if the motor's hot, that causes an instant fire, and you're in really big trouble at that point. But... I don't know that it's fuel related yet, but what I want you to do is do you have any carb spray, a can of carb or can of brake spray?
Probably get some.
Okay. I would get a can of carburetor spray. And when it cranks over but doesn't start, and I want you to use the right words here, it's not that it doesn't start. It cranks over and doesn't start. So there's a difference, because if it cranks over and doesn't start, it's spark or fuel. But if you hit the key and it doesn't crank over, then it's a starter battery or battery connection. So when people come in and they say, my car won't start, we have to ask them, will it not crank over? Is that what's going on? You hit the key and nothing happens? Or it goes, but it doesn't start. So that's kind of what we need to do. In your case, it's cranking over, but it doesn't start. So if you take that carburetor spray and if you take the air cleaner assembly off and you just give it a put the air cleaner assembly back on it, and if it starts and runs for a second and then dies, then you do have a fuel delivery problem. So now, it just doesn't necessarily mean it's the pump. When you park the car at night, we should have the same pressure as you park it at night as you do the next morning. However, if an injector's leaking, then you'll have zero. And if the fuel bypass, the fuel pressure regulator's bad, you'll have zero. And if the check valve in the tank is bad, you'll have zero. So you can't just replace the fuel pump because you only have a 1 out of 3 chance of fixing it. So you have to decide how you're going to fix that. And obviously the repair shops have a way. We can put a gauge on it. And at, 6 o'clock at night, it's got 40 pounds. And the next morning, it's got zero. Okay, we got a leak. At that point, we can pull the spark plugs and look which cylinder's got fuel in it. That's the injector that's bad. And the next night, we're going to pinch off the return line. And then we got 40 at night and 40 in the morning. Oh, okay, then we've got a fuel pump, a fuel pressure regulator, or a check valve in the tank is bad. So there's a process to diagnose this. But the first thing you need to do is answer two questions. Number one, the question is does it start throughout the day with no problem, and it's only when it's parked overnight that you have a problem? What's the answer?
No, are you asking? You're asking me, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's happened so far when I've driven it, the car got warm, and then I turned the engine off, and then came back into the car after going into the store, and that's when it happened.
Okay.
And then it wouldn't start.
All right.
It usually starts right up in the morning.
All right. And I know you're on the fuel trail, but this could easily be in that Grand Marquis. It could easily be an ignition module or a distributor pickup or an ignition switch feed. It can be, because the problem we have to determine is this spark, is it fuel, or is it compression? So we have to figure that out. And the thing you don't want to do is guess, because all of those are going to be expensive. So, and then checking for spark is pretty easy. You pull a spark plug wire. You just buy the cheapest spark plug that they got at the auto parts store. You stick the spark plug in there, and you reach in and look at the spark plug. And if you crank it over and it doesn't go snap, 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 then you say, okay, I don't have spark. And then you let it sit for an hour, and you come back, and you just leave it there, and you hit the key, and it starts up, and you can see the spark, and you go, okay, I don't have spark. But that's what we need to do. It's not good enough, and it's not there is no conclusion that can be drawn that you pushed the Schrader valve and just got a dribble of fuel. That's not part of our industry standards for us diagnosing your no start condition. So I don't want you to go off on a tangent with the fuel idea, because that it could be a fuel pressure regulator, and it could be a check valve. It can be a lot of different things. So. You know what? The diagnosis on this, if you left it in the shop for 2 days so they could start it up or drive it during the day or whatever, if you left it there for 2 days and if they could duplicate it, they'd put a fresh fuel pressure gauge on there, they'd tape it to the windshield, and they'd have, somebody driving around this for 20 minutes and then park it and watch the fuel pressure gauge. And if every time they parked it, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours later, the fuel pressure gauge still held 40 pounds or whatever it's supposed to hold, then they go, it ain't fuel. So at that particular point, then they hook up some other instruments, and they go drive it, and they park it. Then they go back on a hot soak. Otherwise, they go back after they've warmed it up completely. They go back 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, 20 minutes later. This is only, they're looking at your car for 3, 4, and 5 minutes at a time. So the diagnostic process on this might cost you $100, $125. Might. So that would be something that you might want to do. If you want to look at my website, marksalem.com, you can click on Best Car Repair Shops in Phoenix. and you can find one in your geographical area. I've identified the guys that really do care about their customers and really do have the technical ability to find and fix this kind of stuff, and who have been in business for a very long time, and most of them are gray-haired guys, and most of them are no BS, so they're not going to let their employees take them in a direction that they don't want to go. So there's a lot of good shops on my list, and they could help you out. But thank you very much, John, for holding. Thank you very much. Speaking of good shops, up in Phoenix, there's a place called Strictly Diesel. Strictly Diesel is a place that deals with diesels, as you can imagine, but they do foreign and domestic light-duty diesel, so they don't do big trucks. They're located at I-17 and Pinnacle Peak Road in North Phoenix. They've been around for a very long time. They're open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and they sell parts online 24 hours a day at their website. So Nate is a good guy. Nate knows how to treat customers. Nate knows how to diagnose your diesel problem. Nate knows how to make your diesel run a little faster at the expense of some fuel economy, but still, that's okay. So if you have something and you live in the North Valley and you got a diesel, then probably it would be a good idea to develop a relationship with Strictly Diesel, because that's what they do, is Strictly Diesel. When we come back, we're going to talk, and by the way, if you're a Facebook person, if you want to like me, Mark Salem, then you can. And everything I talk about on Facebook is about car stuff. So I just posted a couple of days ago, and the post had to do with Another One Bites the Dust. And it's a vibration that came to us, and the story was very much the same. I've taken it all over the world, and everybody's tried, and nobody can fix this vibration. Now, I'll tell you what we did to fix it, but I'll tell you what we didn't do. And what we didn't do saved us a whole lot of time and our customer a lot of money. And I'm not the only guy in town that can do this. There's lots of shops that can pull this off. But the idea is what are the tricks in making sure you don't chase your tail? And what is it that you want to do before you try to fix this? And, of course, you got to find it before you can fix it. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. If you have a question, we'll take it.
All about that demon, automobile, the metal monster with the polygon.
Welcome back, everybody. My name is Mark Salem. Sitting next to me is my son, Alan. And I've been in business, in the car repair business, for 39 years, and you've been with us for about...
20?
No, more than that.
Well...
The shop here has been open 24 years, and you were sweeping cigarette butts off the parking lot back then and helping the guys with oil changes.
Well, I think that 20 is full-time.
Oh, okay. Because
I just went on my 20-year cruise, so it's... but, yeah, I mean, I've been around for... 38 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, for a very long time. Anyway, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Action Auto Repair. Action is up on I-17 in Deer Valley, northwest corner. Tom owns Action, and Tom and I have been friends since 1983. I know Tom really well. I know that he knows how to fix cars. I know that he can work on just about any car, but he has a BMW expert at his shop. So if you have a BMW and you live anywhere near Deer Valley or an I-17, or if you think you'll drive for an expert, then that's a good place to go. But Tom's been a full-service, family-owned auto repair shop. He's been in Deer Valley since 1983. So no matter what you've got, then he'd be worth a try. Now, all of us understand that we may not be the best shop for your car, and all of us have valid recommendations where you could go to maybe get a better analysis than what we would offer you. So we do that, and so does everybody else, but there's not too many cars that Tom's going to pass on. So I-17 in Deer Valley, and that's Tom. Let me just finish up my thought process here real quick. When we talk about people bringing their cars or parts in and stuff like that, for me, it's kind of embarrassing to say you don't bring your eggs to Denny's.
Right.
That's kind of embarrassing for me to say that, but it drives the point home. You don't take your own meat to, you know, Black Angus, and you don't take your eggs to Denny's and all that other kind of stuff.
Right.
So that's kind of but the problems that creates would be just like Denny's. You bring your own eggs, they drop them on the skittle, and they're bad. Or one of them's bad. So now they got to go get you and bring you in and say, look at this, this is your egg. And you go, no, that's not my egg, that's one of your eggs. So pretty soon there's this battle
right.
on whose eggs got broken on the griddle or not.
Right.
It's just a bad idea. all of us are watching our parts prices. All of us are doing a really good job in making sure that we're given fair pricing. But our part's different than the part you bring because our part's a known good quality part. And, of course, you have no idea what brand you're going to get when you order parts on the online unless you order the part brand specific. And when you do, the top 25% brands are going to cost you a lot more than that bottom. And the bottom end is where most folks go. So when you look at the big picture, it's something like that that you can understand from a point of view. This is just something that comes and goes. It'll be here for a little while, and then it'll go away. It's entirely possible that the 2 and 3 day wait for the part, it's entirely possible that the manufacturers might pull out, not in mass, but certainly some of them, because it's clear that people are using their parts for a known good part. So let's order this, put it on. If that doesn't fix it, we'll box it up pretty and send it back and tell them it was defective. So that's typically what happens. Don, good morning to you. How can I help you?
I'm beyond help. You know that. You were talking about Alan, but hell, if I can remember when he was crawling around down at McClintock cleaning the floor.
Yep. Yeah, he was. He was. He was. I want to tell you something. He was outworked by his sisters in 1985 because they worked harder than he did. He hung around with the technicians, and he was one of their gophers, kind of, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, what's up?
Did Renee tell you that I called and talked to her yesterday?
No, she didn't.
Okay. This week I have towed three 06 Ford Rangers for Takata airbags.
Okay.
She told me to call you back and let you know. So if there's anybody out there that has an 06, now they have to wait for parts, I guess, at Ford. I'm really not sure because I towed one in yesterday and the lady says, we don't even have parts for these, but they don't want you to drive your vehicle because there's a lot of shrapnel in that airbag, and it could kill you. There have been two people killed over this.
Okay, so Jeff, what's the year again? It's an 06, and what did you say?
Ford Ranger.
Okay.
I heard something about this week. Jeff had mentioned something that Ford had come out this week and with their Rangers and something else, maybe an Explorer, don't quote me on that, but that they were telling you stop driving and have a towed immediately.
Okay. And here's what's going on with that. Takata has millions and millions of airbags under recall. There's a little metal box and it contains the igniter. So it's the boom that pops the airbag in your face. This little metal box sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes blows up too. So instead of just blowing up the balloon, like your airbag, it blows up itself, and people are being hit with shrapnel. One of the middle ground there is, and people have said this to me, I think I want to disconnect my airbag. And I said, okay, you're running a risk, because, you know, the airbag, it's not guaranteed that it's going to blow shrapnel in front of your face. It's not guaranteed this little metal box is not going to blow up and hurt you. There's no guarantee it will or it won't. The fact of the matter is we can disable your airbag. We can just unplug it. We can unplug it. And we're going to show you how to unplug it because we're not going to unplug
it. Right.
And so at this particular point, but I'll tell you something else too. It's a matter of there's a lot of people that assume that their airbag's going to blow at every accident, and that's just not true. There has to be a specific energy loss. There has to be you have to knock 12 to 18 miles an hour off the speed of your car in the blink of an eye. So if you hit another car at 40 miles an hour and you only lose 6 miles an hour because the computer's monitoring that because you pushed that car, so it's a soft collision, okay?
Yep.
So you're going to hit this car broadside, you're going to push that car, and we only have 6 mile an hour loss or 7 mile an hour loss. There's a good chance that airbag's not going to deploy.
Right.
But if you hit an oak tree with a trunk that's 10 feet deep at 70 miles an hour or 30 miles an hour, that bag's going to pop because your car's going to come to an instantaneous stop.
Right.
And it has to do with instantaneous. So a soft hit doesn't necessarily. A lady was going down the I-17. She had a seizure. So she bounced off the center wall 3, 4, 5, 6 times. And her husband just went crazy because the airbag didn't blow off, which is a good thing. Because when she came to, and she's out, And then all of a sudden this airbag hits her in the face at 400 miles an hour, and I'm exaggerating there, of course. And then she has to grab a hold of the steering wheel with the airbag covering the steering wheel. So, and we couldn't talk him out of this idea that he wanted to sue GM, but when we looked at the data in the black box, each one of those hits scrubbed off 2 or 3 miles
right,
an hour.
Right.
So the airbag should not have gone off, and hopefully he took our advice. Anyway, Don, you bring up a good point. Ford's covering their butts right now, and they're telling everybody to park their cars with Takata airbags. There are other options, but they come with risks. And so Ford's way is park the car. The question really is you didn't tell me I was going to have to park my car until Takata fixes the problem when you sold it to me in 2006. You didn't tell me that this was a possibility, and I want to explore other ideas. How about a rental car? How about you disable my airbag, and I'll sign a waiver that says that I accept it and I'm smart and I haven't been drinking. There's all these options, but each one of you with an F car is going to have to deal with that because it is an issue. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back, everybody. Behind the scenes, let me tell you what's going on. There's a lot of shop owners that have my phone, my personal cell phone, and they're texting me like crazy about this parts issue. And one of them brought up a good point. He says, you know, I only make 8 cents on the dollar. That's a net profit number, 8 cents on the dollar. He said, so I can't have somebody carve out virtually half of that 8 cents because they're bringing their own parts. So he says, in order to make the 8 cents, and that's a net profit, that's what I end up at the end of the day. I get to keep 8 cents of every dollar, and then I pay tax on the 8 cents. Now, in our industry, according to Dun & Bradstreet, the average shop is between 6 and 8%, and very few shops are in the double digits. And if they are in a double digits, 10, 11, 12, they're certainly not over 15. Although they may say that, they won't provide you the documentation that shows that. So the idea is that one shop owner says, I'm raising my labor if they bring their parts. So he says, I have to make that work. And I think those of you in business for yourself understand that. There's an opportunity for the customer to bring their own parts. If there's an opportunity, then we still have to make the same amount of money because we got all these other cars waiting that we're going to make 8 cents out of every dollar, but on yours we're only going to make 4 cents out of every dollar. So there's a financial reason behind it, and I thank you very much for bringing that to my attention with a text message. Real quick, Kurt's Auto Repairs at I-17 and Bell. He's a really good guy. He has fixed cars. I've sent him cars that no one else could fix, and he's done a magnificent job. And obviously, he looks like a hero, but he makes me look like a hero when I send people to his shop. He's one of all the guys in the best car repair shops list, of my best car repair shops list, can pull rabbits out of their hat, but Kurt does it on a regular basis. So if you live near I-17 and Bell, he's on the northeast corner. JT, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Good morning back at you. The wife says I'm hopeless, but I'm hoping that you can help.
Okay.
Hey, first off, let me tell everybody who's listening, your recommendations for shops is absolutely spot on.
Thank you.
Experienced that in my personal life. So you had a discussion a moment ago about 10 or 12 miles an hour before the igniter would pop on an airbag decrease, you said, in speed?
Yes, yes.
The question that threw me was, what happens if you're hit from the back? What is the expected operation of that airbag igniter if you're hit, you're sitting in the light and you get hit at 60, or you're driving along and you get hit, you know, more than 12 miles an hour? What's going to happen?
Okay, it depends on the year, make, and model and the car, but the answer is today about 10% of the cars are going to pop an airbag to the left side of your head or pop an airbag around you and cup you. So, but 99% of the cars out there, we're talking about a frontal hit. Now, I want you to put the driver in the car, and I want you to draw a line kind of between the rear view mirror on the right and the right side headlight. Okay, I want you to draw a line from the driver, and so we're going to go kind of across the windshield and out what we call the B pillar or the A pillar. And so that angle is where the airbags are designed
from
to work.
From 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock.
Thank you. Thank you from there. 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock.
Steering wheel being 12 o'clock.
Right.
Got
and,
it.
And here's it in a technical form, it's called delta V. It's the instantaneous loss of speed. Now, I want to tell you something that is going to shock you, but according to the doctors I've talked to and according to the accident reconstructionists, around 38 miles an hour, if you're driving down the road at 38 miles an hour and you come to an instantaneous stop, your heart in your chest moves forward. It it contacts your rib cage, and many, many times it rips your plumbing off of your heart. So people, even though they have an airbag, they can still die because when the heart comes discombobulated and disconnected from all of its plumbing, you're going to heaven. Well,
it's
you're
the
going
worst belly flop you ever experienced.
Exactly, exactly. So there's lots of times that people don't survive car crashes that have airbags, and it's because their heart. There's many cases that I have been told about, but a long, long, long time ago, there was two policemen coming south, I think on 7th Street or 7th Avenue, and there was a guy that was high on drugs. He crossed the line, he hit him, and they both died because their heart came disconnected from all the plumbing. And it was an unfortunate situation, and here's the deal. There's not a scratch on their bodies. So that's the thing we're dealing with. But when you get hit from the rear, I'm going to say that 5% of the cars out there today have protection with airbags in the seats, airbags around your head. But the other 95, it's for a frontal crash. That's what we're designing them for. Okay?
Primarily.
Yes.
So that general shove from the back is possibly not going to act.
Well, here's the deal, too. When you get hit in the back, everybody has headrests on their cars, and the seats are supposed to be designed to protect you and not collapse. So when you get hit in the back, it moves the seat into your back and the headrest into your head, and if everything is adjusted properly, you should survive that with no problem. But
very clear description today. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, JT. Thank you very much. Ted, you're up next. How can we help you?
Well, I understand that if you store a car long enough that you'll develop flat spots in the tires. And I have two questions.
Okay.
Would you guess how long it takes for that car to be in storage for those flat spots to occur? And secondly, if they do, can you drive the car and get rid of those flat spots eventually?
That's interesting.
Okay.
All right. Well, we just had the same conversation. Well, it wasn't really a conversation. It was more of an argument.
It was.
About, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago.
Yeah. Him and I, my son and I, had the same argument. And we'll give you both sides of the story.
Yeah.
First of all, it doesn't appear to make any difference whether the car is stored in a cold environment or hot environment. It has to do with the tire being in one position for a very long time and the weight of the car. Okay? Let's get that out of the way. So heat and cold doesn't have anything to do with it. Obviously, time does.
Mm-hmm.
And time has a lot to do with it. The longer it sits, the more it's going to have a flat spot. Now, I want to tell you that if my wife drove a car that had been sitting for a year, it might take her a week to 2 weeks to maybe round out those tires at highway speeds. You with me? Are you going to argue with me?
I don't know that it's necessarily that long, but yeah, I would agree. Okay.
All right, well, let me finish. I know that you could do it in 2 days.
Yeah. Well,
because you're going to go faster, and you're going to corner that thing, and you're going to get the tires hot, and you're going to exercise the heck out of them, but your grandmother, isn't going to happen with her.
Right.
So yes. Now, let me back up. The argument we had was in the old days, when I was around, 68, 70s, we had nylon tires. And nylon,
bias ply, right?
Bias ply nylons.
Nylon, okay.
And they had flat spots, and we could always drive the flat spots out. It was always okay. People would park their tires on top of wood, and they'd put jack stands underneath them and all kinds of stuff. But we said then and we said now, you just drive it, get the tires hot, and they'll be fine. I don't believe that let me put it to you this way. I haven't seen a valid concern about flat bottom tires in the last 30 years, but my son disagrees.
No, yeah, well, I mean, Exhibit A is sitting in our shop right now with that Focus.
Okay.
I mean, that thing sat for a year, and they needed to be replaced because they could not be driven out.
Okay.
I've seen flat spots. I can tell you right now, if my truck sits, and I think too, let me step back and not get ahead of myself. I think air pressure has a lot to do with it.
I agree. If you put them at maximum, you got a better chance.
Yeah, because it limits the amount of touching that the tire is doing on the concrete or whatever it's setting on. So I can tell after a week. If my truck sits for a week, I can tell after a week. But I also don't run mine at max. I can get on the 202 and drive for 4 miles and they're gone.
Okay. We have a Corvette out in the back that gets driven twice a year, three times
right.
a year. We never have flat spots on it. The Camaro out back, and these are stored inside, and inside a metal building, so they're really hot in the summer and they're really cold in the winter. And neither one of those cars.
When was the last time you pulled one of those out in the cold? You have no idea if they have flat spots.
Well, I can tell you this much. You pull it out and park it in the front parking lot. When I hop in it, it doesn't have flat spots. Do you guys go burn the tires on them?
No. I'm telling you, I have taken it from that back area and gone to that golf tournament I go to in Tubac. Yeah. And it takes till Riggs Road or Queen Creek to do that.
All right. In all fairness, Riggs Road and Queen Creek is what, 6-7 miles?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're in the car with one of your buddies and your golf clubs, there's 1,000 pounds right there.
Okay.
I'm teasing you.
Yeah,
and so the idea is that, but the answer to your question is do we both agree that you should be able to drive them out and you're better served by looking at the side of the tire and whatever the maximum
absolutely.
Inflation is to put them that way before you park them?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, how about putting them on wood or leaving them on concrete? You got an opinion on that?
No, I don't.
It has to do with heat. So the wood's not going to get nearly as hot as the concrete in your garage is. So it has to do with heat. So if he goes down to Lowe's or Home Depot and he has them cut 4 squares, 12 inches of half-inch plywood or 3/4-inch plywood and parks them on there, he's going to be a little better off than the guy that doesn't do that.
I'll tell you what, mine is worse in the winter, though. I will tell you that, too. Mine is worse in the winter, but I don't know why that is.
I can tell you.
Well, I mean, just because it's harder? I don't know.
No. Yes, to some extent, but it's going to take longer for the tire to heat up in the winter.
Yeah.
So once you start driving it, in the summertime, the tire's hot by the time you hit Riggs Road from Warner.
Right.
But in the wintertime, it might take you to Casa Grande.
Right.
So,
right.
I don't know. All righty. Did that help you out, Ted? Did we settle the argument?
Absolutely, and I didn't know it was going to generate so much conversation.
No,
thank
it was, this like
is,
I said, this happened a month ago, or 3 weeks ago. We had the same conversation about a vehicle here at the shop.
We disagree on a lot of things. The difference is I have gray hair. And he doesn't.
The difference is he has gray hair, and that's the issue. I'm seeing all the newer stuff, and he's not seeing it. You're right. It is the gray hair.
And in my defense, Ted, I've been around since points and condenser and went through electronic ignition and then went to carburetors that were electronic and then a fuel injection and ABS and transmissions with electric solenoids. And this kid started right in the at the tail end of all of that.
So the defense rests.
Oh, thank you very much. That, you know, did you hear what he said?
Yes.
Yes. And so he's the judge, and he says he just gave a defense verdict. That's what he said.
That's fine. Let me just tell you something.
Okay, go ahead.
How much time we got? We got time?
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I have balanced more tires in the last week than and I think I only did one set this week. I've balanced more in the last week than he's balanced in his entire life.
That's not true.
Bulk.
That's
because
not true.
I worked at Discount. I
okay.
balanced hundreds of tires
That's
a day.
Fine. I'm with you. Have you ever bubble balanced a tire?
No, I use much more sophisticated.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
But back in the 68 and 72, that's all we had. You can't possibly say that.
Yeah, but those tires were stone.
It doesn't. No, we're not talking about the tires. We're talking about the actual
stones, like on the Flintstones.
I started with a bubble balancer. Then we ended up with a Sun machine or a Norcon machine
right.
or a variety of others. And I have been through version 1 through version 20. You have only been with 20 and 21.
No, I have not. I've been through.
Did you ever use the Norcon machine?
No. I think the Bear was the first one. So
okay.
that was, mid-90s?
Yeah, mid-90s.
Mid-90s, yeah.
So, and you know, I use that same thing that you say. I said to a guy the other day, I said, I fixed more cars in a month of my life than you fixed all your life, and you're arguing with me.
Right.
And so, but you can't say that about the balancing because that's just flat out BS.
Oh, I don't know about all that.
Yeah. And I'll tell you something else. I've made more money in gross sales in 5 years of my life than you have in the last 10 years.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. I won that one. All righty, we're going to be back for another hour. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960, and we're going to keep our family arguments to ourselves from this point forward. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem. Sitting next to me is my son, Alan Salem. He's been involved in the business for more than 20 years. And we're here at your service. The lines, we've got two right now that are taken, but we've got three that are open, 602-508-0960. I should give that number more often, 602-508-0960. All righty, we're going to go to the phones, and we're going to take a call real quick. Hank, how are you, and what can we do for you?
Good. I got a 2015 Jeep Patriot, and for the past couple weeks, my airbag light has been coming on and off while I'm driving. Is it something I can fix myself without any specialty tools, or do you know what could possibly be the problem with it?
Well, let me ask you a question, because this just happened to me the other day. I had something heavy on the passenger seat, and I didn't have the seatbelt buckle for stoop, you know, because I don't care. And I drove from Payson down here, and I had the airbag light come on. And the answer to your question is you need scanners. You need a handheld scanner that costs thousands and thousands of dollars. I think we have, how many scanners do we have for all the different kinds of cars?
Lots.
Five, 15, six? I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I would say 10 to 15 probably.
Okay. So the answer is you're not going to, but I do want to tell you this. Have you had anything on the passenger side seat for any length of time other than a butt?
No, not really.
Okay,
Anything? Your dog sit up there or something?
My dog is a tiny little Bichon Frise. He weighs 15 pounds.
Okay.
Did you just say Bichon Frise?
Yeah, Bichon Frise.
See, told you.
Okay,
that's
right.
A real dog. I told you.
I didn't believe it was a real dog. Anyway, here's
it looks
what
like a small poodle.
Yeah, okay, all right. This is what I want you to do. This is going to mess up all your presets for your mirrors and your radio and your seat and all that kind of stuff. But I think it would be a good idea to you to pull the battery cables off of the car. Okay, now when the battery cables are completely disconnected from both terminals, I want you to touch them together, count to 10, set the battery cables down, just and walk away for 10-20 minutes, and then go back and put the positive on first, the negative on second, and see what happens. Sometimes that's called a reboot, just like your computer. When you do a Control-Alt-Delete and you start it all over again, that's what we're doing there. Except when we touch the cables together, we're discharging all the memory capacitors. So everything that's in memory, we're flushing all that out. So I would do that. If not, how many miles are on it again?
About 80,000.
Okay, I would check to see if it's possible that the airbags are still under warranty, and your owner's manual will tell you that. If not, I think you're going to spend between $75 and $125 to have somebody diagnose what's going on. And it could be a seat switch that's bad. It could be something in the power supply. It could be something in the ground. It could be something in the airbag modules, decided to go to airbag module heaven. All that stuff can happen, okay?
Yeah, I called the dealership. They said it'd be about $300 to fix it, and I do all my car work myself usually, so I just figured as long as it doesn't take any specialty tools that I don't have, then I could just probably pop something open and fix it and then put it back.
Okay, now what did they say the $300 included?
They just said that's a common problem they have with the Jeep, and it would be about $290 to $350.
I bet it's a reflash.
Yeah,
I bet it's a reflash, and that is something you will not be able to do yourself. Yeah. Period.
A reflash is just we're going to hook it. We hook up a specific device to your car, and then we dial up the cloud, and the cloud wants money from us. And so then we say, hey, cloud, take a look at this car. And it goes, oh, I see a 2015 Patriot, da-da-da-da-da. And we say, hey, look over all the computer folders in this car. Oh, I see that there's an update for da-da-da-da-da. Okay, well, then go ahead and update it. So and frankly, I think that in the other aftermarket, aren't I safe to say from 150 to 225, 250 for a reflash? We did a BMW the other day.
Chrysler's a little bit more.
Because of the scanner.
Yeah. Chrysler's, yeah, it's probably 200 to 300. That's probably a good number, yeah.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things is if they're talking about a clock spring underneath the steering wheel, which is, you know, if that's something you can probably do yourself if you can go rent a steering wheel puller. But
it would be more than that for a clock spring, 290. I mean, you figure clock spring's got to be $200, and plus, and it's going to be more than an hour labor, so.
Okay, all right. Well, I was thinking of something that would be close to the 300 that you
Yeah, the
quoted.
Only other thing I can think of is something like your truck, where you'd pull it apart and clean some contacts, or you have a bad connection somewhere that needs to be done. I just did one the other day that it was a reflash on the ABS module. Again, he couldn't do it himself, but we're starting to see this a lot, that where they're not...
It's like a Windows update.
Yeah,
it's
just, exactly.
It's an update for your car, except they're not going to do it for free. And so it's the same way with us. When we do a flash, it typically costs us between $80 and $85 for the privilege of attaching to the cloud. And so by the time we add our labor plus our cost, we're at $125 to $175, depending on the cost associated with that.
Right.
So I got one more quick question, if you guys don't mind.
Go.
Is there any harm of me having that light just popping on and off every once in a while? I mean, is it a big deal to get it fixed right away?
Well, let me tell you this.
Does it disable my airbags completely?
Yes. Yes, when that light's on, your airbags ain't going to pop. So, that's the risk and the hazard.
Will all the airbags not work, or just the affected one not work?
But we don't know which one affected is.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. I'm just wondering, is it just in general? I don't know the answer to this. Okay. In general, is it the one? Let's just say it's a passenger one.
Okay.
Will just not the passenger work, or does that shut down all the airbags in the whole car?
There's a whole lot of discussion about that exact same thing. There's a whole lot of fighting going on in the accident reconstruction business and the guys that read the black boxes and all that other kind of stuff. There's a certain amount of them that say, yeah, if the passenger side bag is causing the problem, then the drivers will pop. Others guys say, well, we don't know which one's not going to pop, and that's a risk that the driver has to take. Then they say, no, that light turns off everything. To be honest with you, I think it's more vehicle-specific and year-specific.
You know, one thing you might want to do is at least get the code pulled and figure out which airbag is affected. If it says something about the passenger airbag, I don't know that I would be super... I mean, I'd get it fixed at some point. I don't know that I would rush out today and have it fixed.
It's a 2015, though. It's 4 years old.
Right.
I mean, it's 3 years old.
Three years old.
And the problem with him rolling the dice like that is he could have his wife's at home and he's got his girlfriend in the car. He has a crash and his girlfriend sues him and he's in big trouble.
Yeah, sure. No, yeah.
Don't let that happen.
Thank you for letting us laugh with you, Hank. Thank you very much. Jeff, you're up next, buddy. What can I do for you, Jeff?
Hey, good morning. I have a 2000 Camry with an AC problem I've been fighting for about a year. And in the summer, when it's really hot, I'll come out and even in the morning, it's pretty hot. I'll come out and I'll turn it on, and it'll, you know, within like a second, it'll just click off. And then I click on, and, you know, I'll just alternate it, and maybe about the 10th time, it will stay on.
Okay.
But what I've noticed in the last 4 months, when it's been cooler here, but I've needed the AC, I turn it on, and it works every time.
Okay.
And never clicks off.
What is it?
2000 Camry.
They say, no, 2000 Camry.
Okay.
And they say no leaks. I've been back and they keep saying nope.
That's a poor answer, in my opinion. That's a poor answer. I would be disappointed if my staff did something like that. Here's the deal. We have power and ground that goes to the air conditioning compressor clutch. Okay. We're going to interrupt both of those circuits. So if we put the high pressure switch, otherwise if it sees high pressure, it opens the ground. If it sees low pressure, it opens the hot. So in reality, if you say, this is my symptoms, and when it does work, it blows ice cold, it blows ice cubes through the vents, then everybody knows it ain't a Freon problem. But that doesn't mean it's not a low pressure problem. So there's a lot of us that are gray-haired guys, unlike this kid next to me. So we go in and we grab a hold of the two power and grounds, and we use those big, long wires with a light bulb in it, and we put it into your car, and we say, hey, watch this, Jeff. Or we'll run the negative side, or we'll run the positive side and put two different light bulbs in there, and you come in and you go, it's the red light bulb. That's the one that always, when it doesn't work, the red light bulb is on or off. And when it does work, then the red light bulb is affected. You have to have a wiring diagram, because you have to go backwards from the hot and the ground at the compressor all the way to its source of power and ground. You have to go all the way back. So it can be the button on your dashboard where you turn on the air. That button can be bad.
Right.
It can be the low pressure switch, the high pressure switch. It could also be some RPM sensor on the compressor. I don't think your Camry has it, but there's some that do. So there's just, I mean, you can't possibly work on this until you get a wiring diagram and you start at the compressor and move backwards. And then if it's a situation where we got power and ground to the compressor and it's off, then that means the coil's bad. So the coil behind the hub is bad, and that's what engages the clutch. So then you run an ohm meter test on it, and you ohm out the coil that you have, and just for stupid numbers, it's got 5,000 ohms. Then you order a new one, and you gun it, and it's got 1,000 ohms, or it's got 10,000 ohms. Well, there's a big difference. So if I've got power and ground going there, but I don't have that thing clutch running, and I've got an obviously different setting or a different value on the one you got, the coil that you have versus the coil I got in my hand that's in a brand new box, then I'm going to say to you, hey, Jeff, it looks like it needs a new coil. I have power and ground, so it's not the low pressure switch, the high pressure switch, it's not the air conditioning turn on, it's not the climate control head, it's none of that stuff. It's got power and a ground. So that's what it really is all about. Anyway, good luck to you, Jeff. What part of town do you live in?
One more question.
Okay.
So I can appreciate there's a lot of elements here, you know, from the switch all the way back to the compressor. But the fact that it seems to work great in the cold weather and crappy in the summer, does that suggest anything to you?
No, and let me tell you why not. That's a question I can answer once I find it and fix it. But that's not an area you want to say to me, I want you to work on the symptom that it does it hot and it doesn't do it cold, or does it, it's fine cold and it's bad hot. I don't want to chase that one. That's a red herring. I don't want to use that, because that's not a valid thing. That's a, well, I think this is, now I'm not doubting you. Don't misunderstand me. But I can answer the question at the end of the day after I fix it. I think I'd much rather go to the nuts and bolts of it and the electric. Now, here's something you could do. If you have a wiring diagram, and I'm sure you can find one, I would bypass the low pressure switch. It's just two wires. You just unplug it and you just put a loop in there. And then I'd probably go to the high pressure switch, which is usually at the back of the compressor. And I'm pretty sure it's going to open the ground. It's going to open the ground or open the power. So the same thing, you unplug it and you loop it. But you do them one at a time.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Do them one at a time. Okay. Now, if you bypass the low pressure switch and boom, all of a sudden Mark hit the nail on the head, then here's what you have to do. First of all, you got to go get a low pressure switch. And in order to get it out, you got to drain the Freon. So you're going to have to deal with that.
Got it.
If I told you how to fix it, and the next time the plate passes you, you're going to put an extra $5 in it. Roger?
Right.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Good luck. When we come back, we've got open lines available, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. And just before I throw it back to Gil, let me tell you about Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing. Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing is in Mesa, and they're on Apache or Main Street and Stapley, just east on the south side of the road. Brian and Thelma are good people. I've known them and their family for the last 40 years. I know they're honest. I know they're dependable. I know they're good people. I know they make good decisions. And sometimes, more than I would like, the tie goes to the runner when it comes to making a decision at Thompson's Auto Repair. And that's the kind of people Brian and Thelma, his wife, are. So if you live in Mesa, it's the only shop in Mesa I've got on my list. Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing. We'll be right back. Back, everybody. 20 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem. Sitting next to me is Alan Salem. And together we work on cars. His business is a little different than mine because he takes and hot rods trucks and cars and tires and wheels and lifts them, lowers them, and gas tanks and fuels and modifications. And I'm doing the oil changes all the way to the engine swaps. So in the same building, we've got you covered. Nevertheless, let's go to the phones real quick. Nina, ladies first, you're up. How can I help you?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a real problem. I have a 202 Lexus CR 340, 640. No, what is it? 430, sorry. Okay. And every time I exceed from 45 miles to 80 miles an hour, it shakes uncontrollably. I've had tires changed. I've had a balance. Nothing seems to help.
Well, let me tell you a real quick story as fast as I can. Fill me in if I miss a point. A guy brings us a truck, and he tells us he's had three different kinds of tires, two different kinds of wheels. He's had the drive shafts checked. He's had the suspension checked. He's had this and that and this and that. We have learned not to go by that list. We don't even want to hear that list. We want you to show us the problem. That's what your shop to do. Nina, let's take me for a drive and let me look at it. I promise you that the top 10 of our industry is really good with vibrations. Now, let me ask you this. When the car shakes, is it the whole car shakes or the steering wheel shakes?
Both.
Both. Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. When the whole car shakes, it almost always means it's in the back of the car. And if the steering wheel shakes, it almost means it's in the front of the car. So if you've got both the front of the car and the back of the car, strut rod bushings, I mean, there's lots of different suspension parts that can be wiggling around at that speed.
But it's only between 45 and 80. Does it go away after 80, did you say?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, where are you driving 80 miles an hour, Nina?
Oh, in Anthem on the
freeway. I'm just teasing you.
I would still, regardless of how many times you said that you've had them balanced or looked at, we need to start with the tires and wheels.
But in reality,
really?
We need to drive it.
Yes.
And yeah. And
okay.
Here's something else, Nina. Do you have anybody in your house that drives a car?
Yes.
Okay. This is what I want you to do. I want you to get that other. Is it your husband?
Yes.
Okay, good. I didn't know. You're going to say tomorrow morning, Sunday morning, you and I are going to get out on the freeway. And I'm going. And what we're going to do is we're going to be on our phones. And I'm going to get the vibration to happen, but I'm going to be in the fast lane. And I want you to pull up next to me, and I want you to look at the front tire and the back tire on the passenger side. Then we're going to switch lanes, and I'm going to move over to the right lane, and you come up on the other side, and I want you to look at the front tire and the back tire. I want you to visually look at the tires when the vibration is occurring. Sometimes you'll see a tire bouncing a whole bunch more than the others, which could be a shock absorber, mm-hmm. which could be a bad tire, and a variety of other things. You can save right. yourself a little bit of money if you share that with your shop. But the best thing to have us do is take a ride with you. You show us what you're talking about. And that's the best thing that can happen. I don't know what it is, but I do know on a 1 to 10 scale, those things are about a number 6, 7, or 8 to find and fix.
It's, you know, a lot of people, too, they'll look at a wheel and tire package and say, oh, yeah, it's balanced. It looks good. But in reality, there's so much other stuff that goes into it. There's hub centering. There's lug centering. There's the big thing that we've been running across lately is chrome wheels. If the wheels are chrome, these people, they'll mount them, and we use really good lube to mount them because, you know, tires are getting stiffer to make them last longer, and you pull out of the driveway and the tire will actually rotate on the chrome wheel because the chrome
slippery.
Wheel is slippery. So you are instantaneously at your first stop out of balance again. So that's something that we take a look at. There's a lot of other things than just a balance.
Well, and he's talking about the tire slipping on the wheel, and what we do when we suspect that, and we did it on that one lady, is we put a yellow mark on the valve stem.
Yep.
We put a yellow mark on the tire next to the valve stem, and I'll be doggone if she didn't drive her car down and that mark had moved 6 inches.
Yep.
So we grabbed a hold of her, and we put her in the chair, and we turned on the bright lights, and we said, do you drive like somebody crazy? And she's driving a Ford truck with a blower on it. And so it's a real high-performance truck. And she goes, yes, I have a bad habit of drag racing people. Okay, well, you have to stop that, and we're going to take all that lube off the tires, and we're going to get the tire to stick, and we're going to scuff up the chrome. Is that what we do?
Yeah, so you don't need to drive it bad, and it's typically not Excel. It's usually braking. Usually it's the very first brake that you do. It will move them, you know, the most. It doesn't have to be a panic stop or anything like that. But in order for me to get it to do it, I'll mark the valve and then I'll take it out and really stop it. And even if it moves 2 inches, it's out of balance, period. And we are starting to see it a lot more often now with the lower profile wheels and the chrome, or the lower profile tires and the chrome wheels. And
and the high performance cars behind it, because like you said, it'll do it braking, it'll move the tire on the wheel braking, but it'll also move it when you pour the power to it. So next time you have them balanced, I don't suggest that you do that. But we can scuff the wheel up, we can get all the lube off of it, and we can get the tire to stick to the wheel and stay there.
Yeah, assuming it's chrome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, and we just scuff up the chrome to where it's got a little bit more of a sandpaper to it that holds the tire. That's all. So, yes, the answer is that's not going to be a big deal, I don't think. That one that we fixed here not too long ago was $384, but that had to do with four hub centering adapters.
Right.
This, if you're right, and this is a balance and clean up the beads, what are we talking about?
$150 to $200.
To dismount, clean all of it up, scuff the wheels, put them all back on and balance them.
Yep.
And then mark the stems so that we know if she's out there racing.
Yep.
Or breaking hard. That's it, Nina. Thank you very much for that. Thank you very much. That was a great question. Michael, you're up next. How can I help you, Michael?
Good morning, Mark. After you answer my question, could you please tell the folks about the Saturday afternoon car show in the Kmart parking lot at Power on the I-60?
I sure can.
I was wondering why some of the late model cars, including the Camaros, have the gas cap on the passenger side.
You know, I really can't answer that. I don't know that there's a scientific way. I know that as they build cars, everybody wants this portion of the car, that portion of the car, and even the cigarette lighter moves around in cars for no reason that we can see. Is it a problem when you pull into a gas station that you kind of forget which side the filler's on?
No, I was just curious.
Okay.
I wonder if it's more of a safety thing.
It could very well be a safety thing.
Because if that thing starts on fire, you are, I mean, typically, if you're waiting by your door or sitting in your car, you're going to be on the other side of the car from that.
I had never thought of that.
But you know, I don't know.
Mine's right outside my driver's door.
I understand.
So is yours.
I understand.
And so, you know, if something catches fire, if we're talking on our phone or playing with our phone, which they tell you not to do.
Yeah, I don't, but you do. I know that.
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
I've seen you do it. But anyway, so, I mean, it could be. I have no idea. I'm guessing.
Okay. And I'll tell you what I think. I think it's a matter of logistics. It's, we don't want the filler neck near the exhaust pipe. So that kind of makes a big difference, because we're not going to put the filler neck right over the top of a hot exhaust pipe. Number two, tanks, I think you'll agree, they're going to be centered more driver's side or passenger side. They used to be across the back of the car,
right,
from bumper to bumper, from side to side. But they aren't that way much anymore. Sometimes they're longer and they face the front. Sometimes they're wider. So they're different shapes in different places. But I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah,
but
I don't either.
It's probably related to one of two things. What you said, safety. And the second thing is we had to build the tank logistical. With the filler there because of the logistics. Because we've got the window motor.
That wouldn't explain why there's a multitude of cars over a wide ranging of manufacturers. But, again, I don't know.
Okay. The answer to your question, Michael, is we just don't know. 602-508-0960. Carl, you'll be our next caller on the other side of this break. 602-508-0960. We have four lines available. And we still haven't talked about the idea of what we fixed on that truck and why we ignored all of the list that the guy had and how successful we were.
All about that theme and automobile, the metal monster with the polyglass wheels and
we're welcome back, everybody. It's 34 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock, and we're going to go to see Thomas. Carl dropped off, but Thomas, you're up next. How can I help you?
Hey, how are you, sir?
Good. Thank you.
Good. I had an answer to the last question from the last caller about the gas cap fill being on the passenger or the driver's side.
Sure. Yeah, we're all ears.
With almost 100% accuracy, it's simply due to what side the exhaust comes out on because of the muffler and the catalytic converter being underneath the car on that side. So there's room for the gas tank on the other. And they also, for a safety feature, they want the filler neck for the gas tank to be opposite of the exhaust.
And you know, that was something that somebody already emailed us. But no, that's good that you did that. And you're exactly right. But let me read you something that one of the other guys said. And this is kind of this may not apply as much as yours. Years ago, I was told that Mercedes put the filler on the right side because it was safer to add fuel away from traffic if you were stuck on the side of the road.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm going to tell you two thoughts. Number one, most Mercedes people aren't going to run out of gas. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's just not the thought I have in my head. I think the ASU students and the young millenniums and the younger people, they're the ones that more likely run out of gas. But you don't see anybody north of 40 running out of gas very often. So, but yours has a lot more value because, yes, we have to put the cat on one side or the other. It's always going to be on left or right. And we know people spill gas. They pump it too fast and it comes out. And we also know there's fumes. As you put liquid in, the fumes come out. And so, yes, you're exactly right. I think that would be the leading reason on which side they put it on.
But a lot of these cars now have dual exhaust, though, too.
But the cat, isn't there one cat that we're splitting them on?
No.
Okay.
No, like the guy gave a Camaro reference.
Okay.
Those 99%, even the V6s have dual exhaust.
And dual cats, you're saying?
Well, I know that the V8s have dual cats, but keep in mind, it's got to be behind the rear tire. The cat is up behind the front tire.
Yeah, you're right. The location of that.
Yeah, location of the cat. But even the six bangers have the dual exhaust.
Right.
So.
And then we're still getting some at the middle of the back on the behind the license plate and in that kind of area.
Right.
So I don't know the answer, but these are good reasons why they might do it. Thank you very much for that, Thomas. Thank you very much. Let me tell you real quick about Automatic Transmission Exchange. He's a good guy. Phil and his staff have been at the same location since Jesus was a baby. And that actually started out somewhere in the vicinity of 1960-something. Let me see, 1968, that's what it was. So Phil and his staff, if you live in Phoenix and you have a transmission problem, here's the good news. He'll take a ride with you, or he'll have one of his diagnosticians take a ride. If you can duplicate the problem, I'm quite sure they can find it, bid it, and fix it. So that's the key with the transmission is you have to be able to learn how to make it happen, because if you can't make it happen, then the menu is wide open and that's a bad deal for you. So Automatic Transmission Exchange is on Washington and 40th Street. Good guy. His name's Phil. Judy, you're up next. Judy, how can I help you?
Yes. I have a 2001 Ford Expedition, and I can't find the service paper right now, but it looked like my husband had some Freon put into the car last year, about a year ago or 15 months ago. Now, the car's been sitting for about 6 months. So I just started using the air within the last month, and there's no cold air. The heat's fine, but no cold air.
Okay. That's kind of...
And they said that in order to find out what's going on, they'd have to take it apart. And it would cost about $100 to just take it apart. So I wanted to check with you.
I'm not gonna address them. Let me just tell you what our industry should do. The very first thing we're gonna do is we're gonna go in and take your Freon out and look at it and weigh it. So if you're supposed to have 18 ounces of refrigerant, and if you have 12, then we have a leak. But because we've taken the Freon out and weighed it, then we're not halfway to the repair, but we're certainly 25% towards the repair, because now we're going to draw a vacuum on your system and we're going to try to find the leak. Or we can put your Freon back in with the dye and go drive it and find the leak. So we're all assuming that this is a Freon issue, but this could be something completely different. I think your diagnostic fee, no matter what it is going to fall between $75 and $125. I think the necessary steps to determine if this is an electrical problem, a Freon level problem, maybe too full, too empty, or any one of the other number of electrical items that's supposed to turn that on that can't turn that on, 75 to 125 is, I think, your number. Now, it's entirely possible, but it's a small percentage. 20% of the time, it's $100 to find it and $25 to fix it. So there are some of those, but it can also be $100 to find it and cost you $350 to $1,000 to fix it, because if the compressor itself is leaking, then you have to replace the compressor, the orifice tube, you have to flush everything, you have to put all new Freon in it, and there's a lot of labor and there's a lot of parts. But really, now's the time to have this checked out, because the prices are going to go up when it gets really hot. So it's easy to sell a compressor for a little less during the cooler times than it is in the middle of the summer. So that's my advice to you.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, ma'am. You're welcome. Real quick, we had that expedition come in.
Yes.
And he had a vibration.
Uh-huh.
And we talked about all the different things that he had done.
Oh, yeah.
Three sets of tires, two sets of wheels, driveline angles, this, that, mm-hmm. balance. And I like what you said. You said you ignored his list.
Yeah.
And so you went out and drove it.
Yeah.
That's the first thing you got to do. And you could duplicate the problem.
Yes.
All right. Now, folks, let me just tell you. The old days when I was a kid, we had a balancer that was as much Fred Flintstone as you can ever imagine compared to today. But I want you to think about this. We got to take a break.
Yeah.
So,
I thought you knew that. Okay.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the differences in balance and what the difference is between today and yesterday, and the sophistication level will really surprise you. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. It's 43 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock, and let me finish the story. The guy comes in with the expedition. It's got a bad vibration. He's had everything imaginable touched or set, and he can't find anything wrong. Take it from there.
Wow, that was a dump off. Went for a ride. I knew it was at that point, I knew it was a wheel and tire issue. There was no question in my mind it was a wheel and tire
issue. But he had three sets of tires and two sets of wheels.
Yeah, I don't care.
Okay.
I've heard that a million times.
Okay.
So the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to make sure, check to see about the hub centricity, or if the wheels and tires were hub centric. They were not. So I had some hub centering rings made first because I wanted to balance with the hub centering rings.
Okay.
So, put some hub centering rings on, made a little bit of a difference, not a huge one. Then I brought it in for balancing, found two of the tires had over 100 pounds of road force.
And a number on road force is much better at what?
Limit is 36.
Okay, so you want them under 36.
Yes.
And this one had more than 100.
Yes.
And you couldn't possibly get it much lower than that.
No, I got it to 58 and 60, I believe.
Okay.
Was able to match mount them to 58 and 60.
And what hub centering rings and center lug centering, what we're talking about is the tire's got a wobble to it because it's not spinning on an axis.
Yeah.
So it's one side, is the spokes are longer on one side than the other. And so when you ride, it's like that bike on the commercial that's got the square tires on it, and he's driving along and you can see the square tires. It's a problem with the center of the pinwheel.
Right.
If you put the center of the pinwheel too far up or down, then the pinwheel is going to spin abnormally.
Right.
So by changing the center of the wheel mount, you fixed that problem.
Right.
Then you went back and balanced all the tires, and you found still two of them that were out of whack.
Yes.
And
yes.
So
balance was good on all four. Okay. Decent on all four.
All right.
But the main issue was the road force.
Okay. And so in the big scheme of things, it has to do with this, too. The fact of the matter is that most tires have about a 6-inch heavy spot. Right? 6 to 10 inch?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
A heavy spot. Now, we're going to move the heavy spot opposite of the wheel heavy spot.
Right.
So if the wheel heavy spot is at 12 o'clock, we're going to move the heavy spot of the tire to 6 o'clock.
Right.
The problem is with his BF Goodrich tire, the heavy spot was from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock.
It was a much larger heavy spot.
Much bigger.
Yeah.
So now you have to move the tire at a couple of inches at a time, trying to get your road force number down.
Right.
So after you move the tire, you still couldn't get it anywhere close to the 35 and below that you wanted it.
Right.
But he wrote back and said, I had a number 10 vibration, which is a bad number, and you moved me to a 2.
Right.
So he said, I came in with a 10 and you moved me through a 2 and nobody else moved him
and
anywhere.
And the only thing that's going to get you to zero is replacing those two tires.
Right.
Because they're still out of spec.
Okay. So then we're going to move from a 2 to a 1.
2 to a 0.
A 0. Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm not going to claim 0, but you
I
can.
I will.
Okay, fine. Fine, fine. Oh, Michael, he said power and 60, there's a car show on Saturday night behind Walmart, 3 to 6. If you like old hot rods and you like to mingle,
it's in the Walmart parking lot, not behind Walmart. I think Walmart parking lot.
Okay. Well, I thought he said behind, but nevertheless, it's at or near the Walmart there on Power and 60.
Oh, I think he said Kmart, but he probably meant Walmart.
Okay.
Anyway, regardless.
And then we also had a call here on the Camry. Do you remember the Camry? Jeff said he had an old Camry AC problem. Sometimes it would work in some way. Sometimes it wouldn't. Okay. I got a beep, 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 beep from a friend of mine. If the compressor has an RPM sensor, I've seen several times when the belt's slipping, the head pressure is high, causing the belt to slip, and then the compressor will shut down. I've had customers start the car with the AC off on a hot day, make sure the AC is off, and then turn it on, and most of the times that works. The real repair is get the belt to stop slipping on the compressor, so either adjust it or replace the belt. But this is a diagnostic procedure. So when we talk to Jeff, he says, when you turn the car off, turn your air off when you know this is going to happen. Then start the car and wait for the count of 10 or 20, and then turn the air on and drive away. If that makes all the difference in the world, then you either need to adjust the belt that runs the compressor or replace the belt that runs the compressor. And so that helps them. Don, good morning. How can I help you?
It's me again.
Uh-huh.
What do you guys think about E3 spark plugs?
Well, it's kind of like a water hose. You have one water hose and you split it into three hoses. And so you have a little less water in each one of those three hoses because there's only so much water we can move through a hose. And the E3 spark plugs you're talking about are brag about having three sparks.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we've been running tests on those since those kinds of spark plugs with the fancy sparks. And here's what we do. We can measure the amount of electricity it takes to jump the gap. Then we can also measure the burn time in millionths of a second. And when we tested those fancy dancy $10, $20, $30, $40 spark plugs, we found that they didn't use any more electricity, but if you added up the burn time of all three of them, then you would come up with a standard Champion or an Autolite or a Bosch Platinum. It's not anything that we sell. It's not anything that we will install unless the customer absolutely insists, and then we will. But we're going to put a disclaimer on there that these spark plugs were not designed for your car, and if you have a miss or a problem with them, then we're not going to chase that problem down. But it's a fancy marketing idea, and it's no different than a lot of other auto parts that brag about stuff that just physically can't happen. That's
if you really want to know, go out to the drag races next weekend. Those cars are out there, fastest cars in the world, 10,000, 11,000 horsepower, and ask them to see their spark plugs in and see if they've got any of that crap in them.
Well, but they have stickers on them where they market that stuff.
Absolutely. But I can tell you with 100% certainty, I have seen those spark plugs.
Yeah.
I have held those spark plugs. My kids have them. My kids have them in their bedroom, and they are.
What are they?
I can't remember off the top of my head.
What brand?
But it's a
conventional spark plug.
Conventional spark plug.
Center electrode and loop on the top.
Yep, and they have a, most of them were burned off now.
Okay.
And they have two per cylinder.
Okay.
But, they are a conventional, no frills, no split fire, no nothing.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it. Thank you very much for bringing that up, Don. Thank you very much. Bob, you're up. How can I help you?
Good morning to you, Dr. Mark. Alan, you're learning at the knee of an automotive genius here.
Easy.
lost my phone here a minute ago. I got a new one, and
easy.
I put it on speaker and screwed it up. But anyway, first thing, a year or so ago, I got a 98 Ford Ranger. You told me to do the Adelief. I had droopy drawers, and you did the Adelief. I did that, $75. It solved the whole problem, beat the cake. The other thing, it is the car show is probably up to Kmart. You can't get near that Walmart at 60 and power this time of year with the snowbirds here. So the Kmart's on the other side of the road. Here's my problem.
Okay.
98 Ford Ranger, 137,000. Remote door lock thing. Sometimes it's real slow. Sometimes it doesn't work at all, especially the driver's side. Suggestions?
Yeah. And let's forget about the driver's side altogether. Do the other doors work better or the same?
Probably the same. No, a little better. The passenger door works a little. Yeah, the passenger door works better because you double click it, and it almost always opens right away.
Okay. Well, the lock cylinder, which is an electronic solenoid on your Ford, is manipulated and run by the master switch that the driver uses. And as you can expect, the driver's doors gets 10 times more use than the rest of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I don't want to use the truck, yeah.
Yeah. So I think what I would do is I would say to you, I want to pull the panel, the door panels on the two front doors, and I want to run an inductive amp probe test, and I want to lock and unlock both sides. If the passenger side has a 15-amp hit when it unlocks or locks it, and the other side has a 45-amp hit, then I want to replace the solenoid on the driver's side because it's clearly worn out and it's clearly using far more electricity to open and close than the passenger. But before I replace that solenoid, I want to run a ground drop test or a volt drop test on both the power and the ground. I want to make sure I have a full 12 volts going to that solenoid, and I want to make sure it has a good power. So those are the things that typically would happen. Now, the only other option is for you to wait until it gets really bad, and then we just take the driver's door apart. So
okay.
Those are the two ways that we're going to happen. Now, every once in a while, we take the driver's door apart, and we find hamburgers and hot dogs and clothing and all kinds of stuff inside the door. And actually, you take it apart, you clean it all up, you get all the grease off of it, you lube the heck out of it, put it back on, and voila, it's fixed. The risk you run there is if that solenoid has been working really hard for a long period of time, just because we cleaned it up and lubed it doesn't ensure that it's going to live forever. So most of the time I suggest to people that we just go ahead and replace the solenoid. All right?
Okay, but run an amp comparison test on both sides.
Yep.
Check the voltage. Make sure it's getting full voltage.
Yep.
Clean it. But if, yeah, I'm with you. I think I'll probably just replace the solenoid. What the hell? It's easier.
Well,
okay.
And there's a couple. You know, I had one guy said, I'm going to put the passenger side on the driver's side. I'm not going to put something in the passenger side. I'm just going to swap them. And if it obviously the problem goes away, then I'll get a new one and put it on the driver's side and move it back, or I'll put the new one on the passenger side and leave the passenger on the driver's side. So you can do that kind of a comparison. As long as you do it scientifically, you'll be fine. Okay?
Extra work, but thank you.
Yep,
okay,
you betcha.
I might as well replace it while I'm in there.
Absolutely. Thanks, you betcha. S&S Tire Service is in the West Side. They have three locations, Peoria, Surprise, and Goodyear. They've been around since 1976. They've been around a long time. They're owned and operated by gray-haired guys that have been around tires their entire life. Now, they don't just do tires. They have a huge comprehensive line of tires of so many different brands. So you can go in there and point to your tires and say, give me a good, best, or better. And they'll give you pricing for all four tires, two tires, out the door, write your check before we even start on your car. So if you're going to turn your car in on a lease and you just want to put tires on it, then go ahead. But the idea is they have a huge selection. They also can balance your tires. They also do all the tire-related stuff, which is alignment and suspension, but they also do oil changes and other stuff. So if you're in the West Valley, I think one of the best, if not the best, tire location would be the S&S Tire in Peoria, Surprise, or Goodyear. It's a good place to stop, doesn't take long, and you can have the opportunity to look at a variety of tires for your car. Go ahead, Gil.
Say hello to Martin.
Martin, good morning. How can we help you?
I have a 2012 Dodge Ram 2500 Cummins diesel. 70,500 miles on it, and the performed service light comes on.
Oh, let
now
me. Go ahead.
That's CCV, right? And EGR cooler and all that kind of stuff.
All right, hold on. I'm sitting next to the guy that knows more about that truck than anybody I never met in my life.
Good.
Go ahead, Alan. This is yours.
No, that's a CCV filter. I would replace a CCV filter. I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, we don't perform all that EGR cooling.
Is that something really to be concerned about? Or
I've not had any issues with them. I know that a lot of my customers have gone to the dealerships for other stuff and got their wallet flushed on that service. But
yeah, it's like $1,200.
Yeah.
All right. So what you're telling him is just replace the CCV filter,
yes,
and roll the dice.
Yes.
And the odds of him having to do something additional to that are slim.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There you go.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. All righty. And actually, that's exactly the same conversation I had with that cowboy over at the car wash not too long ago. He was faced with that big $1,200 da-da-da-da-da-da, and you said to him, just replace the filter. Now, I've not heard whether he had success or not, but let me ask you about your success rate, Mr. Big Shot. How many of them end up coming back after you replace the CC filter?
Well, they're not even the same system. The okay. EGR and the CCV, they're not even the same system. I don't know where they're getting that from. I don't even know if that EGR service is even in the owner's manual.
Okay.
I know that some dealerships are performing that, but I've yet to see it in an owner's manual. So it comes on at, I thought it was 67.5, but maybe it's 70,500, but it's right around there for the CCV filter. Every time it's in every truck.
And you don't have any of them come down back.
No.
Nobody's coming back.
It's not a check engine light. It's okay. It's just a, so you just reset that light and you're done.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so nobody's coming back.
No.
So, all right, that's a pretty good record. Anyway, mark@marksalem.com, and you can send me an email address if you'll give me your phone number. I'd like to call you back because I hate to type. And every Saturday we're here from 10 to 12 right here on KKNT, and you're welcome to join us. But my email address again is mark@marksalem.com. So wear your seatbelt, and I'll see you next Saturday.